Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Gostola, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm one of the show's hosts. I'm very pleased today to be joined by Asadeh Shashahani, who is a legal and advocacy director of Project South. She's also the past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and she's been following closely the way in which repression and attacks on Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims have expanded in the United States as the Israeli military and the Israeli government pursue their war on Gaza. So welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And to begin, let's start broadly with war as the backdrop, as the catalyst for what we're seeing, particularly here in the United States. We'll have a discussion, but if there's anything globally you want to bring into the conversation, you're definitely welcome to do that. But as we've seen the targeting of activists ramp up, as we're hearing stories of more FBI visits, perhaps Homeland Security, cybersecurity people are going to be involved in going after individuals. You contextualized this for an article that you co-authored that was published at Middle East Eye within the larger global war on terrorism policies that have existed over the past 20 plus years in the United States. And so I'd like to ask you, as we begin, how do you fit what is happening right now, the moment that we find ourselves in the United States, and how do you compare it to what has been experienced when people tried to engage in freedom of speech or expression or tried to engage in protest and assembly, particularly Palestinians, Arabs, or Muslims, over the past 20 years? This moment that we're seeing is this more dramatic. It feels more dramatic to me than what has been experienced previously. So I'd like to give you an opportunity as we begin to dive into the issues to start off with your own reaction to what you've experienced and what we've all basically been observing over the last 2 months.
Thank you so much for having me. So I think we need to start by talking about the dehumanization of Palestinians and Arabs and Muslims. So the dehumanizing rhetoric employed by Israeli government officials, very much echoed by Biden and the US government and this administration, and to some extent, you know, leaders in Europe. And you know, that has a very significant part to play in terms of then giving a green light to policies and actions attacking Palestinians in Gaza. As we have seen, a genocide is in the making in Gaza, with vicious attacks on hospitals and mosques and churches, while, you know, the US and Europe, for the most part, just look on. And then also coupled with that, then the US government and, you know, its agents and universities going after Palestinians and Muslims and really everybody and anybody speaking out in support of Palestine. In a lot of ways, you know, the US government relying on the same framework and structures that have been established and strengthened and really perfected in the past 20 plus years since 9/11. So the same, you know, structures of surveillance and criminalization of protest and dissent. We are now seeing that play out in a very frightening manner. And so, you know, you see now that student speech on campuses is potentially going to be criminalized. So in a very dangerous move, we had ADL and the Brandeis Center sending out a letter to these university heads, encouraging them to investigate chapters of Students for Justice for Palestine as potentially being connected to terrorism. So now, speaking out in opposition to Israeli human rights violations and speaking out in support of Palestinian liberation could potentially be investigated as terrorism, which has actual very frightening prospects because, the U.S. Federal statutes are very broad in terms of, defining what constitutes material support for terrorism. And so the FBI, they could get involved. And then the next thing you know is prosecution of students and then, imprisoning them for a very long time. So this is where we are right now. And I think we all have to be very vigilant and also on alert about what this means for our movements and really try to put a stop to it before it gets even worse.
That's a good broad way of approaching some of the specific developments. Over the past week, we've seen, particularly in the House of Representatives, the U.S. House of Representatives, that there's Republicans in charge of, I think it's an education committee, that have signaled that they would like to go beyond just inviting university presidents to come testify about what they perceive as anti-Semitism. Of course, they're conflating this Palestinian protest, the support for Palestinians, as anti-Semitism. They want to go beyond just having a hearing where those presidents testify. They want to do a full-blown investigation. And so I invite you to react to that. But I know that you've specifically tracked or paid attention to the deactivation of Students for Justice in Palestine chapters. Most prominently, we saw in Florida that Ron DeSantis wants to go after the student groups that are protesting in support of Palestine. So what's your response to seeing the attack specifically on these SJP chapters throughout the country?
Right. So DeSantis, as always, took the lead in terms of repressive measures. And of course, a lawsuit has been brought because this is obviously in violation of First Amendment rights, and free speech is supposed to be the cornerstone of, democracy in this country. And now, that is definitely subject to question, given, everything that we have seen. And yes, you have this, conflation of anti-Zionism and, expression of support for Palestinian liberation with anti-Semitism, which, again, is a very dangerous move. It can affect organizing and movement work in a number of different ways, including, activism on campuses, elsewhere, out on the streets. And again, could then potentially lead to criminal prosecution. And so universities really need to be speaking out in support of their students' free speech rights. Unfortunately, we have seen some universities, such as Columbia, private universities actually go ahead and try to deactivate chapters of Students for Justice for Palestine, as well as Jewish Voice for Peace chapters, in an attempt to really suppress movement work in support of Palestinian liberation. And of course, what we saw was that that had really no impact in terms of student activism. Rather, it galvanized a lot of various student organizations to try to band together in support of Palestinian liberation and support resolutions and movements for divestment from Israel. And so, and we also have seen, you know, NYU Law, unfortunately, instead of supporting one of their students, the president of the Bar Association, who actually courageously put out a statement in support of Palestinian liberation and then had their job offer revoked by a law firm. So instead of supporting them, the law school is basically potentially subjecting them to investigation and, you know, really pursuing action that, you know, makes it easier for organizations such as ADL and also the, you know, the U.S. government to go after folks who speak out in support of Palestine on university campuses.
It feels like we are potentially in a moment of panic or a scare throughout the history of the United States. You know, we've had like the communist scare, right, where anti-communism ramped up and there were people who were targeted. That was how they delegitimized civil rights organizations, particularly in the 1960s, and other organizations that were protesting the Vietnam War, for an example. And now anti-Zionism, it seems, or just pure Palestinian solidarity, has the potential to become the focus of the of a scare. You were speaking about the material, or you were speaking about the way that people could be investigated for terrorism. Material support for terrorism has been something that defined the way that there was repression under the global war on terrorism. And so if they bring that back, can you speak a bit about what it has meant previously for those to be broadly applied? Because our Justice Department has been willing to target peaceful, nonviolent Muslims, Arabs, Palestinians with these material support for terrorism laws that they have on the books.
Right. So as an example, we had the Virginia Attorney General's office announcing their investigation into the nonprofit American Muslims for Palestine over allegations of using funds to, quote, support or benefit terrorism. And this move is really reminiscent of post 9/11 targeting of Muslim charities and institutions for investigation and prosecution based on alleged ties to designated foreign terrorist organizations, you know, organizations designated as, you know, so-called terrorists by the U.S. government. And so, for example, in the wake of 9/11, you had the targeting of five Palestinian American leaders of the Holy Land Foundation, which at the time was the largest Muslim charity in the U.S. And they were prosecuted in 2008 under this statute, and they were accused of providing humanitarian aid to charity committees in the Israeli-occupied Palestinian territories. And prosecutors argued that these committees were run by Hamas, which is a designated foreign terrorist organization, though the U.S. government provided aid through the same committees and continued to do so after this prosecution. So again, you see this, you know, really dangerous, you know, threat in terms of what's happening in this country and the years and decades of precedent of U.S. government engaging in prosecution and a lot of times preemptive prosecution. So, you know, going after people who haven't really done anything. You know, we've had a lot of cases of entrapment. So the U.S. government, in effect, creating crimes. So devoting a lot of resources to, you know, targeting poor folks with, you know, promises of money and financial rewards, and then going after them, and then subjecting them to, you know, prosecution under these statutes, and then putting them away in prison for long periods of time. And so, again, this is something for us all to be wary of.
Definitely. And in fact, I'm aware, because I'm based in Chicago, that there were FBI raids against Palestinian solidarity activists in 2010, around that time frame in the Midwestern United States. Eventually, there weren't any charges brought against these people who were engaged in activism, but these were people who ended up being targeted simply because they were taking trips to Palestinian occupied territories in order to either link up with charities or observe what life was like living under an apartheid state, and returning with that knowledge and using that to amplify their activism became something that the FBI took interest and wanted to prosecute or put them under a microscope. So I presume that you, I presume you went to law school, otherwise you wouldn't be doing this work as someone who had been in the past president of the National Lawyers Guild. I'd like to get your response to what the climate is like right now for law students.
Yeah, again, it's frightening. So yeah, we've seen a lot of job offers being revoked by law firms, and also very repressive atmosphere in a lot of the law schools. I should say not only law firms, we've seen even, legal defense organizations trying to revoke or go after their own unions for speaking out in support of Palestine. We have seen, mainstream legal organizations that have no understanding or are unwilling to have an understanding about, what is happening in Palestine and sort of link up the oppression of Palestinians with, the oppression of, Black people and, the sort of, U.S. government oppression against, other communities in the U.S. We have this phenomenon called progressive but on Palestine, and you see it, play out very strongly in the legal field. On the positive front, though, I should say that there's been a lot of movement by law students, so on universities in general, but, in law schools. So you had, students from various law schools across the country band together and issue a statement in support of Palestinian liberation about a month or so ago. And really, being there in support of each other, which is really important, right? Because isolation breeds fear. And it's really through organizing and coming together and providing support to each other that we can strengthen the movement. Hopefully a lot of these law students speaking out in support of Palestinian liberation can go on to have really bright future careers as movement lawyers. And I, for one, am looking forward to working with all of them.
We've seen from the administration of President Joe Biden that a number of officials are willing to speak out, not only in justifying the violence that is happening in Gaza, but also in equating the protest that we're seeing on the streets to something that is hostile towards the dignity or respect of Jewish people, feeding into this idea that somehow these solidarity protests are promoting Jewish hate. We saw Corinne Jean-Pierre, I know that you mentioned this in your article, she was equating some of these protests to the rally, the Unite the Right rally by Nazis in Charlottesville. That was particularly just odious, the way that she characterized the people who have been out in the streets. And so what do you think about the cruel indifference that we've seen from these officials? I mean, on one hand, I think that it's really sad that these officials are the face of the United States to people in these Middle Eastern countries and around the world that are appalled at Israeli violence. But then also, I recognize what this means, the destructive result of advocacy from these U.S. officials. So what do you say to their indifference?
Yeah, it's egregious, shocking, but I should say not surprising, right? I mean, here you have a settler colony, the United States, supporting another settler colony and settler colonial system and apartheid, called Israel. And so, supporting them in any way that they can, through rhetoric, through financial and military support and diplomatic support and every other way that they possibly can, for a variety of reasons, geopolitical and their strategic reasons, in the Middle East. And also, I think one should point out the deep-seated racism and Islamophobia that you're seeing play out in this situation, but also hearkening back to the long record of US government attacks and wars against Muslim people and people in the Middle East. So speaking again of the US so-called war on terror, where the US government attacked many peoples all over the Middle East. And so, as Israeli officials like to remind the US government, some of their actions are very similar and reminiscent of US government actions in various countries in the Middle East, from Iraq to Syria, to Libya, to the actions of their ally Saudi government in Yemen. And so, this partnership between the US government and the Israeli government comes naturally. But thankfully, more and more people are waking up and understanding, what is happening here and what is promising really. And giving me personally a lot of hope is, the young people waging massive protest and groups such as Jewish Voice for Peace. Saying that, you can't do this violence and aggression and commit genocide in our name. You don't speak for us. And so the rising movement in anti-Zionist Jews taking to the streets and banding together with Palestinians and Muslims and progressive folks against war and genocide and imperialism is really hopeful, and I, for one, am optimistic about the future of the movement.
I don't know if you'll have anything to add here, but when you speak about the racism, that's been on full display over the last 2 to 3 years when we're talking about how a genocide gets applied to a country that engages in a war of aggression. And the way that you've seen officials who were willing to maybe even let down their guard and allow the International Criminal Court to investigate Russia and their war in Ukraine. But now we're seeing when the Israeli government is engaged in this bombing campaign against people in Gaza. And there have been executions in broad daylight of Palestinians in the West Bank. When you see the systematic violence, the targeting of journalists and their families in Gaza, and the hundreds of children that are being killed, it seems almost every day in Gaza, that there's no finger being lifted, there's no investigation. There have been constant questions from journalists to the State Department spokesperson, Matthew Miller, about whether they are looking into these war crimes. They say, well, they're not able to make an assessment right now because the conflict is ongoing. And so it's left to the United Nations, which in the past week has taken this unprecedented step of invoking an article in their charter to try and push for a ceasefire, to force a moment where there might be a ceasefire. But the US really isn't doing anything. And I think it sends a signal to the Arabs around the world just how racist the government is when it comes to caring about these lives.
No, exactly. And then, when the US government then speaks about human rights violations by, other countries, such as Russia, then, the rest of the world, the global South, obviously has a reason to, be a skeptical and point out, US hypocrisy. And yeah, again, I mean, the way that crimes against the Ukrainian people were highlighted by the U.S. government and officials. Should be the way that crimes against any people, including Palestinians, are highlighted. And again, the International Criminal Court, there's been a lot of criticism of it for the right reasons in terms of its hypocrisy when it comes to investigating war crimes and, crimes against humanity when, it's the U.S. government or it's an ally of the U.S. government like Israel that's committing them. Whereas, when it's African governments or, other governments that are not an ally of the U.S. And so all of that needs to be pointed out. And U.S. government officials, among others, should be held accountable. And I should say that, we see that also play out in terms of immigration policies. So the way that Ukrainian refugees were treated by, by Europe, by, Poland, and by the U.S. government should be the way that Black and brown refugees and asylum seekers and migrants from, from the Global South are treated, including Palestinians. And of course, what we see the opposite of that, in terms of countries putting up militarized borders and really strengthening their borders with, various means, including, with the support of the Israeli government, to try to prevent Black and brown and Muslim people from gaining asylum and refuge. And so, the hypocrisy in all of this, again, needs to be highlighted and examined and rebuked.
And just one more thing, and then I'll have one final question for you about accountability for war crimes. But I do think it's worth pointing out, because this past week there were certain individuals in the Western press that were promoting this idea that Hamas has not released hostages that are women because they would like to rape them or sexually abuse them and continue to keep them in captivity. And this was said without any basis whatsoever. There was no proof put forward. And when journalists questioned at least one or two U.S. spokespeople, they were not given any information as to why this was uttered. And somewhat stunningly, we saw the Israeli Defense Forces, for whatever reason, say that they were kind of put off by this. They didn't think it was helpful to them trying to wage their efforts to get these hostages back to Israel. But I note the racism that is behind this. The idea that these militants in Hamas or any other Palestinian resistance group, that if they capture people, they're going to rape them, that to me is racist. And the idea that if you speak about instances and examples of Israeli soldiers abusing Palestinians, as has systematically been proven to happen, that completely gets pushed aside. There is no conversation about any sexual abuse that is unfolding in prisons within Israel right now.
Right. And I would encourage folks to take a look at a report by the National Lawyers Guild that's actually focused on the situation of Palestinian political prisoners. So I was part of National Lawyers Guild delegation, and we focused on this exact issue of, the issue of administrative detention, where, people's, imprisonment in, Israeli prisons is continued indefinitely. And really the whole system of, military prosecutions of Palestinians under occupation, and the whole range of violations, gross human rights violations that Palestinians face while imprisoned by Israel, including Palestinian children, and also, the violations that women face. It's a good resource for people just to be aware of what Palestinians are experiencing in Israeli custody.
Thank you for that recommendation. Lastly, Henry Kissinger, who was Secretary of State and also was a consultant, someone who boasted about the number of presidents that he was able to advise. Of course, many of those presidents seemed pleased to be able to turn to Henry Kissinger for advice, which I think is a sad statement about the United States. It's understood and recognized that there are millions of deaths that are that were at the hands of Kissinger and his policies. We could run down a list of countries, but he died at 100 and he was never held accountable. And people celebrated that he was dead. It was this cultural moment where people were pleased that he didn't exist in human space anymore. But at the same time, it's been pointed out that he lived 100 years and was never held accountable. And even when he was challenged for committing war crimes, he didn't answer questions. He didn't really address the issues. At one time, he even tried to suggest that war criminal was a pejorative, like a slur that you shouldn't use against people. So what do you think about the moment of Henry Kissinger's death, and then how it happened to coincide with what we're seeing unfold with the Israel government and its military in Gaza, and the war crimes that are happening as a backdrop that, you know, we're not really even certain how we begin to have justice and accountability for those acts that we're seeing, that we're witnessing.
Right. Yeah. I mean, when I heard news of his death, the first thing that came to my mind was, you know, another war criminal died without facing accountability. And of course, you know, what I was expecting and we saw was the accolades and, you know, all the expressions of, you know, sadness for, you know, his passing and trying to, you know, celebrate him as you know, a genius of, you know, foreign policy, et cetera, while, you know, whitewashing his really odious record of, you know, enabling wars and coups and, you know, massive human rights violations and displacement of people all over the global south. And also, I think it's an instructive moment for us to try to hold war criminals accountable while they're still alive. You know, so, you know, George W. Bush, Netanyahu, Biden, you know, where is the accountability for these people? And while, you know, mechanisms such as the International Criminal Court, as you just spoke about, have shown themselves to be grossly inadequate and really not, you know, up to the task for a variety of reasons, including political. People's movements do have other mechanisms available to them, such as people's tribunals that can serve really important functions in terms of lifting up the stories of survivors of human rights violations. So providing people a forum to talk about what they experienced. And then also establishing a record. So building up, you know, a huge, hopefully significant record that can then be used, you know, down the line, hopefully by an impartial judicial tribunal. And so, again, I would encourage folks to check out resources that exist on People's Tribunal, including a National Lawyers Guild article on what People's Tribunals are and how they can be used by people's movements to hold accountable war criminals and other human rights violators.
I believe what you're speaking about with the tribunals, that there was something along those lines when it came to the Iraq War. Because there was such outrage that those Bush officials were never held accountable. And of course, we saw torture, and there was never any accountability for that when it came to the Bush White House. And then, of course, with President Barack Obama's administration, you had the revolutionizing of drone warfare and no accountability for officials who were authorizing those extrajudicial killings abroad. And so, yeah, I think what you're saying fits into what the challenge is for all of us, because I think at the core here, the reason why this violence is continuing to unfold is because there isn't any force that can really stop the U.S. government from standing behind Israel, the Israeli government at this moment, and giving them permission to continue with the atrocities that we're observing. And I think that puts us in a very difficult position, because not only do we have to defend our rights to speak out, but we also have to, as advocates, journalists, and people who care about humanity, come together and try to figure out how we force accountability.
Right. I mean, I think the only force that can stop the U.S. government is people's movements, which is, you know, really the only force historically that has established made any progress, sustainable progress, as we saw, you know, with an end to the U.S. war on Vietnam. And actually, you know, the first example of a people's tribunal that we know of, speaking of, it was the Russell Tribunal. So looking at the crimes of the U.S. government in Vietnam. So that, you know, set a really good precedent. But again, you know, I think, what is happening across college campuses, across, you know, our universities and churches and community spaces is people speaking up and really not fearing the consequences. And so that's, you know, that's what we need. More and more people speaking up and coming together.
And it has been heartening to see the 300,000 plus people that went to DC and protested several weeks ago. And then how, you know, you have Jewish Voice for Peace that have been leading demonstrations. The demonstration at Grand Central Station in New York was, I think, a major display of solidarity. So you're absolutely right. Thank you for coming on the show to do this interview. Before we end, can you tell people where they might be able to find you, follow your work, if there's anything you want to say before we conclude?
Thank you so much. So I would encourage folks to take a look at our website, Project South. Project South is on social media. I myself am on Twitter, and people can also find my writing on Muckrack, and also hopefully people can also take a look at some of the Law Review articles and other resources, including the article on People's Tribunals.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this week's episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast. We'll be back next week with another show.